This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. As horrifying as the September 11th attacks were, my guest Graham Allison believes it's more likely than not that sometime in the next decade, Americans will experience something far worse, a terrorist attack with a nuclear weapon. Allison's new book, Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe, is an alarming look at just how accessible nuclear weapons and weapons materials are, and why the nuclear programs of Iran and North Korea stand to dramatically increase the threat. Allison believes that a nuclear terrorist attack can be prevented if the United States changes course and makes nuclear safety more of a national priority. Graham Allison was a founding dean of Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government and served as an assistant secretary of defense during the Clinton administration. You open your book, Nuclear Terrorism, with a chilling anecdote about a tip that the CIA got just, I think, a month after the September 11th attack. I'd like you to describe that information and what it tells us about the state of our vulnerability to a nuclear terrorist attack.
Well, this is an actual incident, not well known because it turned out to be a false alarm. But just a month, almost to the day after the assault on 9/11, the director of CIA went into the president and said that an agent named Dragonfire, appropriately, had reported that Al-Qaeda had a 10-kiloton nuclear weapon from out of the former Soviet arsenal in New York City, and there was even some specific information about the characteristics of the weapon and the fact that it might have entered the U.S. from Canada. In any case, the alarm bells went off in the very, very inner circles of the U.S. government, and for several days, people had to confront the possibility that there was actually a nuclear weapon in New York. The president asked, could Al-Qaeda have a 10-kiloton weapon? The answer was, well, yes, they could. Were there 10-kiloton weapons in the former Soviet arsenal, some of which may be unaccounted for and might have found their ways into Al-Qaeda's hand? Yes, there could be. If it entered the U.S., would we know? The answer was, well, no, we probably wouldn't. If it's in New York City, can we find it? And the answer was, unlikely unless we get some additional clues. So for several days, people looked very hard at the problem. It turned out to be a false alarm. And in fact, they never even told Mayor Giuliani, who, after he learned of the fact later, was somewhat upset about it.
Everyone knows that a nuclear terrorist attack in the U.S. would be a catastrophe. But in your book, you describe in some detail what a nuclear weapon going off in Times Square would do. What was your purpose in going into that kind of detail? What would happen?
Well, what I do in the first chapter is imagine, as people had to do in October 2001 when they thought a 10-kiloton weapon was in New York City, if that weapon were exploded, a 10-kiloton weapon, what would the consequences be? Well, a 10-kiloton weapon is about the size of Hiroshima, to put it in perspective. That was 12 kilotons. For the first third of a mile from ground zero in all directions, one would have nothing. It would just be vaporized. It would disappear. And out to a mile, buildings would look like the Federal Office Building in Oklahoma City. So you could imagine 500,000 people dying promptly in such an attack in New York, if it was midday when the place is crowded. And over time, several hundred thousand more, maybe even ultimately 1 million people dying in relatively short order. So it's just, this is a level of catastrophic consequence that most people can't imagine.
Well let's take some of the places where weapons might be available. There were thousands of strategic and tactical nuclear weapons in the former Soviet Union. Is there evidence that some of them have already been stolen? What is the state of security at these weapon storage sites?
Well, now there's a Ukrainian friend of mine who, a number of these weapons were in Ukraine, he says, well, you keep talking about the good news, which is that all the weapons were taken back and, are in Russia. But the bad news is that all the nuclear weapons are taken back and are in Russia today, where they're vulnerable to theft. They're in the efforts that have gone on over the last 12 years, the security at the nuclear weapon sites has improved in Russia. in a number of the sites, and the U.S. has been involved in assisting that. But it is still the case that about half of the weapons and potential weapons in lumps of highly enriched uranium and plutonium are relatively vulnerable. That is, they have not been secured to a level that we in the U.S. would regard as acceptable. And that means that there's 10,000 weapons that are at risk, some of them at facilities where, as I've seen with my own eyes, when you see a fence that it looks like it wouldn't be difficult to go through or go over, or a guard at a facility where there's no metal check for people coming out. And there have certainly been cases where material from which weapons could be made was stolen, but we know of no case in which a weapon itself was successfully stolen. Now, there's one of those sort of stories that's still out there that I've continued trying to trace down, in which a fellow named Alexander Lebed, who was Yeltsin's national security advisor for a while, acknowledged that 84 suitcase nuclear weapons, which had been made for the KGB back during the Cold War, were unaccounted for. The Russian government reacted rather strongly in old Soviet style by denying that there were any such weapons, and then saying they had all been destroyed, and then saying none were missing. So there was a whole bunch of conflicting stories that they offered about it.
Graham, I have to interrupt and ask you to explain what on earth is a suitcase weapon, and what was the KGB doing with them?
The U.S. had something called atomic demolition munitions and other very small atomic or nuclear weapons that could fit in a backpack. And the purpose of these was for going behind the lines if there should be a war and blowing up bridges or blowing up headquarters or other. And in the Soviet case, they had these Spetsnaz units, which were very effective, which would go, again, behind the lines and try to kill the political leadership of a country, or to blow up major buildings and facilities or headquarters, or to blow up bridges. And small nuclear weapons were quite suited to that purpose.
Literally a nuclear bomb you could carry in a suitcase?
In a suitcase or in a backpack, absolutely. So the smallest ones weighed about 60 pounds, and others weighed about 90 pounds. So that's heavy. So that's a heavy suitcase. But put in a backpack, one person could carry it quite adequately.
Apart from finding a already made nuclear weapon, the fear is that terrorists could build their own bomb. How much fissile material, that is to say, highly enriched uranium or processed plutonium, would a terrorist group need to build a bomb? I mean, were we talking about something that would you need a dump truck full? Would you need a suitcase full?
For the basic Hiroshima-style bomb, which is the easiest bomb to build, you would need about 100 pounds of highly enriched uranium. And since this is very dense, very heavy material, that would fit in a six-pack, roughly. So you empty out a six-pack of beer or Coke and fill it with highly enriched uranium, and that's about how big it is, smaller than a football. The design for the weapon is essentially a no-brainer, the Hiroshima bomb. That bomb was never tested. That design, actually, the first time ever used was used over Hiroshima. And that bomb would fit in the back of a van, like the van that the al-Qaeda terrorist Ramzi Yousef parked in the World Trade Center in 1993 when they tried to blow it up. So you're talking about something roughly the size of a football or smaller, a device which would fit in a van, and a design which is unfortunately rather straightforward, and which has been public information now for 30 years. So it's a 60-year-old technology, therefore not rocket science.
Now, you said that you could fit enough highly enriched uranium to make a sizable nuclear weapon in a space about the size of a six-pack of Coke. Can you transport that safely? I mean, does it give off radiation? And could someone literally walk out with it and sell it without worrying about damage to their health?
The damage to the person would be quite small, since it doesn't have a big effect in terms of their health. In terms of the ability to detect it, it does give off gamma rays, which can be detected if unshielded. But again, unfortunately, if hidden in a lead container, like a camera bag, this becomes almost impossible to detect. So here nature is sort of against us and advantages the hiders versus the seekers. Since 9/11, there's been a major effort in research and development at the U.S. weapons labs and elsewhere trying to improve detection capability. But today, if a terrorist succeeded in getting 100 pounds of highly enriched uranium, their difficulties in bringing it into the U.S. would be slim. And our ability to find it, if it's in a city, is as one of the nest people. These are the people who are the teams that are prepared to go try to search. They say it is like looking for a needle in a haystack of needles. So we're not well advantaged there. The crucial thing to recognize, therefore, is that the source is the place to lock the material down and the place where we have the best chance of succeeding.
What role have Pakistani scientists and the government of Pakistan played in spreading nuclear technology?
There's been this fantastic story of A.Q. Khan, who's the father of the nuclear bomb for Pakistan, who is the global nuclear black marketeer, as we've learned over the past year, as the sheets have been, sort of pulled back. Here, this man, right at the heart of the Pakistani nuclear weapons program, who successfully stole technologies out of the Netherlands back in the 80s and surreptitiously built the Pakistani nuclear weapon using black market networks, then sort of flipped the switch sometime in the 80s and began himself going, black marketeering these same nuclear technologies that he was developing for Pakistan. So this is a story most people just simply haven't gotten. But as the head of the IAEA, Dr. Albaradei, has said, he created virtually the Walmarts of proliferation, harnessing all the forces of globalization and the inventiveness of the market to supply people who had nuclear ambitions. Now, we learned the most about this in Libya, where now Libya, having come and confessed and opened itself, provide just a treasure of intelligence about how this network worked. Khan had set up gotten a company in Malaysia to set up a manufacturing facility to manufacture centrifuges, which are the machines that make the nuclear weapons material. He had gotten money flows through a Brit and an Israeli who were operating out of Dubai. He had some Americans even compromised in this process. So this was a global network for production. He ended up getting some uranium hexafluoride, it looks like almost certainly out of North Korea, to supply to the Libyans more than a bomb's worth of material, which if run through the centrifuges, these machines, would have produced enough highly enriched uranium for a nuclear weapon itself. And then he sold nuclear consulting services. So all this has been going on now. His markets or buyers included Iran, Iraq, Libya, and three or four more countries that have not yet been publicly outed, but which I suspect should happen over the next several months.
What consequences, what punishment did he suffer for his actions?
He went on TV, he confessed, and he was granted an instant pardon, and he continues to live in a rather grand house in Pakistan. He's as well regarded in Pakistan by the population as is President Musharraf. So this is a very difficult tightrope that Musharraf has been walking.
Is that a troubling lesson to be sending to people who want to engage in nuclear piracy?
You bet. And I would hope that Musharraf is squeezing him in order to get the information from him about the rest of this network so that it can be rolled up. But I don't know that that's the case, and I worry.
Graham Allison, you write in your book that Americans are no safer from a nuclear attack today than we were at the time of the September 11th attacks, and the central reason, you say, is our war on Iraq. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is a tough proposition, but I have tried to analyze the situation carefully, and I would say the following. With respect to nuclear terrorism, what we know that there are people who would like to conduct a nuclear terrorist attack. Bin Laden, the chief example, but not the only one. In fact, I give a half dozen other groups in my book. And that what stands between them and a nuclear terrorist attack? Acquiring a nuclear weapon. In the case of Iraq, there were no nuclear weapons. There was no nuclear weapons program. So this was a false premise with respect to the case that was made for war. But we also know that in North Korea, there are likely two nuclear weapons that were made under the previous Bush administration. But then there's enough fuel. There were 8,000 fuel rods that were frozen until January of 2003, since which they've been being reprocessed to produce enough material for six additional weapons. So here we have, in the case of North Korea, certainly more potential nuclear weapons today than we had back before 9/11.
And are you saying that North Korea restarted its nuclear weapons program because we kind of took the eye off them because we were so focused on Iraq?
I don't think they restarted it because we had our eye off. What I'm saying is that while we've been focused elsewhere, they've been engaged in this activity with impunity. So they withdrew from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They kicked the inspectors out. They shut down the cameras that had previously been watching this material to make sure that it was not reprocessed, and they started reprocessing this material to produce enough stuff for six additional weapons. Now, this, a country, North Korea, which is currently in the lingo called missiles or us, so they sell missiles to whoever will buy them. They've sold missiles to Iran, Iraq, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Libya, whoever will pay, they sell. They are potentially going to become nukes or us. And I think one has every reason to believe that if North Korea succeeds in becoming a recognized nuclear weapon state and completes its current efforts to have a production line for an additional dozen weapons a year, they will sell nuclear weapons to other states and even to terrorist groups. And I've written in the book, and I do believe this will be judged, if this happens, the greatest failure in American diplomacy in all our history, because a nuclear North Korea with a nuclear weapons production line will produce a world that maybe not just of one nuclear terrorist acts, but of multiple acts. So the North Korean case has kind of gotten almost out of the barn while we've been focused on Iraq. That's the first instance. The second instance is Iran. Again, in terms of potential for supplying nuclear weapons to terrorists who could attack us. So this is the only, I'm only looking at this piece of being safer against nuclear terrorism. Iran has been, in the past 2 years, completing the infrastructure for its nuclear weapons program. Now this gets a little technical, but I think if I explain it briefly, if a state is able to make highly enriched uranium, which you make by enriching uranium ore, or alternatively to make plutonium, which you make by reprocessing the spent fuel that comes out of a nuclear reactor, it then has the stuff of nuclear weapons. That's what's hard to make. That's what's hard to get. But once you have highly enriched uranium or plutonium, the rest of the process is relatively invisible and relatively easy. Iran is just about to complete the infrastructure for its nuclear weapons program as well. So while we've been focusing on a relatively minor, a bad regime, a bad man, a cruel dictator, Saddam Hussein, so I have nothing to say for him except that he was not the primary target. If your concern is a state and actors who would acquire and supply nuclear weapons to terrorists who could attack us.
As to the notion that the United States focused on Iraq while letting North Korea and Iran, letting their weapons programs grow unchecked, what about the argument that the invasion of Iraq, like the invasion of Afghanistan, sent a message to everyone that the United States will act with enormous force and will against a state it regards as a threat. That in effect there is a deterrent effect that could have an effect on a Korea or in Iran.
Well, I would say I think that's a reasonable consideration, and I remember talking to Paul Wolfowitz about this, a person whom I know well. And I believe that was a good part of the core of their argument, that this was going to be easy, they were going to do it quickly, it was going to be seen as successful, and it would be a demonstration of America's unique military power. And there's, I would say, particularly if it had turned out to be a obvious and apparent success, and if there had been a nuclear weapons program, which, as I say, CIA never believed there was a nuclear weapons program there at this time. Their best estimate was that it was more than a decade away.
And you said, let me just interrupt there, Graham. You said that even though there have been a couple of recent reports which maybe re-examine this notion that Iraq was trying to buy uranium from Africa, right?
I would say that Iraq had nuclear weapons ambitions is correct. I mean, Saddam never gave up his ambitions. The question is, how close was he to realizing those ambitions? If he had bought the yellow cake that President Bush talked about in the State of the Union speech from Iraq, imagine he had even bought it successfully. He's still a decade away from a nuclear weapon unless he's completed the facilities for enriching uranium. That's the hard part. Getting yellow cake is not hard. And in the
yellow cake is the crushed uranium ore, right?
It's an early stage of, if you think of it like gold, it's like, it's gold that's been panned a little bit, but it's still not been refined in any significant way, and you're trying to get to 24 carats. This is way at the front end of the process and is not the hard part. The hard part is the centrifuges and a cascade of centrifuges that are able to enrich this to the 24-karat gold stuff that you need for the bomb. In the case of Iran, we had everybody agreed, all the intelligence community, all the national security community, that they were working this problem very hard and were getting closer and closer to success. And now we even see that we know more about AQ Khan's activity. He was one of their main helpers and suppliers. So I would say we get some effect, some demonstration, some positive demonstration effect from showing that we can crush a regime easily like Saddam and Iraq. But as we now see, we find ourselves left owning it and with a bit of a quagmire. And the most important thing, and this is my point, that while we were consumed elsewhere, if you look at the amount of energy and capital that of the president, of the secretary of state, of the secretary of defense, of the defense establishment that was sucked into that hole, while North Korea and Iran have not been sleeping. They've been sneaking down the track as fast as they can.
You have a fairly well-developed suggestion on how the United States should deal with North Korea, which, as you said, is on the verge of being a country with a nuclear weapon production line and a willingness to sell it anywhere. How should we handle North Korea?
I think we need to take out all the carrots that we can imagine and mobilize them, both our own and carrots that can come from North Korea, from South Korea, and from Japan and others. And secondly, all the sticks, including all the sticks in our arsenal, and fashion a strategy on the basis of which we sit down with North Korea bilaterally now and say, we're simply not going to accept, and we can't live in a world in which you become a nuclear weapons state with a nuclear weapons production line selling nuclear weapons and materials to other states. That's unacceptable for us. So that's not going to happen. We've got to have a whole series of benefits for the North Korean regime if they go in the direction that we want. On the other hand, if you fail to do that, we're going to explore a whole set of options in terms of sticks, which start with sanctions, but ultimately contemplate military action to prevent this from happening. Now, playing out that hand in a careful way, in a manner that mobilizes what we can from South Korea and Japan and China, which has got a great interest in this, and Russia, is very hard to do. But if I contrast this strategy with the strategy of the Bush administration, it has simply been one totally befuddling. No carrots, so we're not going to give you anything, and no sticks. When you withdraw from the NPT or are reprocessing plutonium, we don't do anything to you. We simply tell you, we're not going to talk to you until you agree that you are going to eliminate your weapons program, and indeed, as President Bush said, and also commit suicide for your regime, because we want your regime to change.
Back in the Eisenhower years, the United States had a program to help develop third world countries called the Atoms for Peace program. I guess it was an effort to assist countries in developing nuclear power. What's the legacy of that program for nuclear safety?
Ironically, danger. Both we, under the so-called Atoms for Peace program, and the Soviet Union under a matching program, provided research reactors to many developing countries and some what now turn out to be transitional countries, some of these powered by highly enriched uranium. So unfortunately, as a result of that, there are now about 20 countries where one can find research reactors of often risky and vulnerable to theft, at which you would find more than a bomb's worth of highly enriched uranium. And these include countries like Belarus or Uzbekistan or the Czech Republic and even in Ghana, one's got almost enough material at a risky research reactor. In my view, and as part of this no loose nukes program, we would go around and clean out all that material, and I would say it should be done not on the current timetable where Secretary Abrams says over a decade maybe he's going to get the job done. This should be done this year.
Well, is it true now that even if one of those countries wanted to send its plutonium back to the United States, we actually charge them $5,000 a kilogram to take it?
Well, there's been this just bizarre, I mean, the stories in the bureaucracy are just hard to believe. But for a long time, now from the most risky ones, I think that's gotten adjusted. But for a very substantial period of time, the folks noticed that nobody was sending the material back. And one of the reasons why was they were being charged to do this as opposed to being incented to do it. So this has been a backwater in the Department of Energy. Secretary Abrams has now focused on it a little bit more clearly, and I think that he's got the right idea. He's just got the wrong timetable. It should be done immediately. We know how to do it. We've done it successfully now in three countries. In the former Yugoslavia, three potential nuclear weapons were taken out finally in the summer of 2002. Imagine that material was the stuff that powered the nuclear bomb that exploded in an American city. What are we going to say, well, it was scheduled for removal in 2007, but we just hadn't got there yet.
Well, Graham Allison, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for a great interview.
Policy analyst and former Assistant Secretary of Defense Graham Allison. His book is Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe.